recent attacks on top scientists, let us take the case of Richard B. Alley. He is the Evan Pugh Professor of Geosciences at Penn State University. Alley is a fellow of the American Geophysical Union and a member of the National Academy of Sciences. His popular book about ice cores is called The 2 Mile Time Machine. Alley was expected to give one of the best speeches of 2009 at the annual general meeting at the AGU, and he did not disappoint. I'm Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, and I'm going to give you a short digest of that hour-long Bjerkny lecture to the AGU in San Francisco in December. Professor Alley begins with the attack.
Now, this is where I said these are interesting times. Okay, this is a copy of an email that was sent to my administration by an alum. And said alum copied me on this, so I believe I am fair. The alum asked for certain personnel changes to be made, and I have just put in the ones that relate to me. So for what it's worth, Dr. Alley's work on CO2 levels in ice cores, now I don't actually do that, but I talk about it. Okay, Dr. Alley's work about CO2 levels in ice cores has confirmed that CO2 lags Earth's temperature. This one scientific fact alone proves that CO2 is not the cause of the recent warming. I continue to mislead the scientific community. There should be prompt response getting rid of me. I have crimes against the scientific community, Penn State, the citizens of this great country, and the citizens of the world that must be dealt with severely because of my shameful activities. Okay. So there'll be a wanted poster up here somewhere. But the thing which is fascinating, and we'll come back to, is that this email has in it a logical fallacy which is evident on casual observation. And I think it's worth our understanding at some level how polarized the world is, how easy it is for someone to misunderstand our science if they aren't fully within it, the amount of education, the amount of outreach, the amount of clarification that we have to make to get from this to a proper scientific understanding.
In fact, the former Penn State grad calls for an investigation into Dr. Alley's activities that will start prior to the end of this year, end quote. Later in this program, we'll follow Professor Alley as he explains the denialist bugaboo of carbon dioxide lagging temperatures as they rise in climate history. In excerpts from this important speech, we'll learn more about the scientific history of our planet and its atmosphere, the place where we live. As we will also learn, this was part of a concerted effort against climate scientists at Penn State, including the famous hockey stick graph creator Michael Mann and others, but that's another story. Bjerkny's lecture is one of the keynote speeches to the American Geophysical Union annual meeting every year. Named after a famous Arctic researcher, Penn State's Professor Richard B. Alley received an award for his work teaching the history of Earth's past climates, and he gave this speech at the December 2009 meeting in San Francisco. The title of the speech was "The Biggest Control Knob, Carbon Dioxide in Earth's Climate History." The entire speech with an accompanying slide can be seen in a 57-minute video, and I've given you the link to it in my blog entry for January 7, 2010. Find that at ecoshock.org. The first 20 minutes of Alley's speech goes into the many ways that scientists can measure past CO2 levels. These include actual air samples trapped in ice cores, plus a whole range of cross-checking available from seabed analysis, shells of creatures, the way leaves are disformed, or even the teeth of some mammals. It's a list of techniques too long to list here. In a sense, this is the most important foundation for everything we will hear next because it establishes how we know. These are not mere guesses or religious beliefs, but the results of millions of careful measurements by hundreds of thousands of scientists around the world. The result is compiled and cross-checked by large scientific bodies, including the National Academies of Sciences, to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change through peer review and criticism by the world's scientific community. The results are not opinion and are moving towards established facts about our world. Please listen to the speech. Dr. Alley explains with graphs the rock weathering thermostat that operates over long periods of time to balance both the CO2 and the temperature on our planet Earth. This was developed by Walker Hayes and Casting in 1981 and has stood the test of further research. Now, beyond the facts as we know them, such as the amount of certain carbon isotopes in rocks, we have the level of theory. Scientific theory stands until it is proven incorrect or superseded by a better theory. Einstein's theory of relativity is still a theory, as is Newton's theory of gravity, but we managed to send humans into space and broadcast television based on these theories. In some areas, we still don't know. That is the realm of conjecture. We guess, based on the available evidence, but admit our ideas may be wrong. When dealing with the very deep past of our planet, for example, there is more conjecture. As we are mere humans trying to understand our home planet and the serious risks we might pose to it, you and I need to go beyond the child's demand for complete certainty. We must embrace an intelligence based on being able to separate facts, theory, and conjecture. There is a role and a place for each. Just because we are uncertain about some things does not make all climate theory wrong. At times, denialists attempt to defeat science because of its honesty. Dr. Alley tells us about the coldest times labeled Snowball Earth, but we begin our radio coverage with an event that must concern us all. 250 million years ago, there was a massive extinction called the Great Dying.
Right, 251 million years ago, basically almost every critter on the planet dies. The Great Dying, the end Permian extinction. Maybe 95% of the species go, but because you can keep a species alive with a reasonably small number of individuals, this is really nasty. Okay? And it turns out that there are bugs in the ocean, green sulfur bacteria, that use hydrogen sulfide rather than water in their photosynthesis. And they have very interesting biomarkers. And those biomarkers are found widespread at the time of the dying, which means, and these things are living in the photic zone of the ocean, and they're living on hydrogen sulfide, which means that the ocean's surface is full of hydrogen sulfide. And if you breathe very much hydrogen sulfide, you die. And it's probable that that was true for a whole lot of oxygen-breathing critters back in the past. And so sometime here, the ocean gets full of hydrogen. It runs out of oxygen, and then it gets euxinic, and it fills up with hydrogen sulfide, and then it kills off most stuff on the planet. And it turns out that that happens to be a warm time. There's a big warming coming up to that. And the warming seems to have been because there was a big volcanism.
This is the theory popularized in the book Under a Green Sky by Peter Ward. Listen to our Radio EcoShock interviews with Dr. Peter Ward, especially the Under a Green Sky interview in September 12, 2008, and then his later explanation, the Medea Hypothesis, in the October 10, 2009 Radio EcoShock show. It's best to listen to the earlier interview first. Isn't it important to know the worst-case climate scenario and how it developed? If that explains how rampant warming could kill off 95% of life here on Earth? One great extinction, that of the dinosaurs, was not caused by warming or excess CO2. Of the five great extinctions, scientists theorize four were caused by warming, but the dinosaurs were killed off by climatic conditions set off by the crash landing of a meteorite into the Gulf of Mexico. The dust blown into the upper atmosphere brought a darkening and a cooling that ended many life forms.
Tried to save myself, but myself keeps slipping away.
We know that Earth has experienced extreme warming, where crocodiles played in tropical seas at the poles.
Now, come a little farther forward in time. We're now in the Saurian sauna of the mid-Cretaceous. It's still hot. There's no ice near sea level at the poles anywhere. You have balmy temperatures. You have forests crowding up to the edge of the Arctic Ocean. The continents are not that different from now. And if you put them in a model, as has been done, you know, you melt all the ice and the sea level gets a little higher and that changes the planet's albedo a little and you get a little bit of warming and you move the currents around and you might a little bit of warming with some configurations. You can't get much. And so it's really stinking hot. And the only explanation we can find on this is that CO2 is really high again. And probably, again, because volcanism is running pretty fast. If you put high CO2 in the models, you sort of match what happened, except that the world seems a little bit too warm at the poles. If you leave the CO2 out of the models, you don't get very close. The only way we can attribute this warmth of having an ice-free world is to have a high CO2.
But let's look at another horror example from Earth's past climate shifts. This is the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, something that looks possible for us even today.
And that's a very interesting little blip. It's where the Paleocene meets the Eocene, and it is a thermal maximum. So we call it the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum. Geologists are fairly literal sometimes. Okay, what do we find there? There's a big isotopic anomaly that it says CO2, CO2, CO2. Maybe starting as methane, but going to CO2, okay? There's a big temperature change. The whole world is already hot, and it cranks up a few degrees C in a fairly short order. The ocean acidifies, and all the shells on the seafloor are dissolving, and there's a big extinction event of things that live on the seafloor. Pretty much all the ecosystems get kicked around. There's huge migrations. There seems to be the start of some evolution going on. There's a lot of ecosystem disruption. Things get out of place and out of time, as it were. You can't possibly blame this on drifting continents. It rises in a few thousand years, and it falls in a few tens of thousands, 100,000 years. So this is not a drifting continent thing. It's the CO2 shows up, and it gets hot. And it's fast compared to other things. And the way that it recovers looks just like our carbon cycle models. It's beautiful.
Allie continues with a detailed timeline of Earth's temperatures, showing a direct correlation between CO2 and temperature periods. The measurements, again, are amazing for their breadth, running from soil and sea samples to fossil teeth to leaf damage and fossil leaves, the work of scientists all over the world over decades. Boom, the CO2 goes up, and boom, so does the temperature, like dancing partners. There were times that didn't seem to fit beyond the meteorite hit, but, says Allie, in the last decades, almost all of these have been reasonably explained, and most turned out to be CO2-related after all. At the 40-minute mark in the talk, Richard Allie goes into the science discounting other theories of climate disruption, such as volcanoes or the influence of the sun. Of course, there are many factors in this complex system, and volcanoes and the sun, among others, do matter. But myriads of scientific studies show they are not the control knob when it comes to climate. CO2 is. One theory, which still needs more research, is this.
This one is important to carry home. People say, oh, wait a minute, the sun doesn't change much, but the sun modulates the cosmic rays modulate the clouds modulate the temperature, and so the sun is amplified hugely.
I believe this is the main theory from dissenting University of Alabama scientist Roy W. Spencer. He's coming out with two new books from the conservative publisher Encounter Books titled Climate Confusion, How Global Warming Hysteria Leads to Bad Science, Pandering Politicians, and Misguided Policies That Hurt the Poor. That'll come out in January 2010, followed just 2 months later by another book called The Great Global Warming Blunder, How Mother Nature Fooled the World's Top Climate Scientists in March 2010. A barrage of denial of human-induced climate change and a comfort to fossil fuel producers and users everywhere. Allie says of this theory,
it's really interesting hypothesis. There's really good science to be done on this. But we have reason to think it's a fine-tuning knob. Because this record, this is 60,000 years ago on the left up to today, and this is a record that is beryllium-10 in the ice core, and the beryllium-10 is made by cosmic rays. Now, the sun modulates cosmic rays, so do the magnetic field. And 40,000 years ago, the magnetic field basically zeroed out in what we call the LeChomp anomaly for a millennium or so. And when it did, the cosmic rays came screaming into the Earth system, and you see in basically all sedimentary records this peak in cosmic ray-produced nuclides. We had a big cosmic ray signal, and the climate ignores it. And it's just about that simple. These cosmic rays didn't do enough that you can see it. So it's a fine-tuning knob at best for this picture.
Alabama scientist Roy W. Spencer has also denied the theory of evolution, replacing it with intelligent design and creationism, theories embraced by the deeply conservative Christian movement.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Here's the end of the talk by Professor Richard B. Alley of Penn State to the American Geophysical Union, December 2009 in San Francisco.
So where do we end up? We're gonna get out of here in a hurry. If higher CO2 warms the Earth, climate history makes sense. And if CO2 doesn't warm, we have to explain why the physicists are stupid, and we also have no way to explain what happened. And it's really that simple, okay? We don't have any plausible alternative to that at this point. And so it surely looks like it, you know? CO2 can be a forcing, it can be a feedback. The warming effect of a CO2 molecule, it does not remember why it's there. It only remembers that it is there. And the paleoclimate data show that sort of the mid-range models are right. And if there's a problem, the world is a little more sensitive to CO2 on some time scales than the models tend to produce. Now, be clear, there's lots of knobs that control the climate. The sun knob, we're really lucky, it doesn't get twiddled very much. The cosmic ray, the space dot, the magnetic field, and the other knobs, if they matter, we can't find it yet. They're really interesting things to be learned, and I hope that the science rolls forward on those. But so far, they're either not doing anything or they're not doing much. They're fine-tuning knobs, is how it looks. Okay? This is not a regional story. All right? You close the Isthmus of Panama and the people that used to have coastal property don't anymore. They're climate changed. You take India from the pole and you run it to the equator, it's climate changes, okay? The Unger Dryas was a big regional thing. There's lots of things in regional climate that don't do much to the globe. The Unger Dryas is cold in the north, it's warm in the south, it doesn't do much to the global temperature. In terms of the things that people care about, CO2 is just a start. It's not the end. There are real interesting things to be done in here, okay? And I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done here yet, because where we really stand now, we're not quite yet at that pound on the table, this is nailed, we're done, this is our confidence interval level. The paleoclimate data are coming in real fast, they're real good, it's really sharp, but sort of these latest advances have not had time to percolate through to the IPCC yet. And so we're going to see more on this. We're going to see more discussion on this. This story is very clearly not done. Okay? But it's fairly clear where we stand now, which would be an increasing body of science indicates CO2 has been the most important controller on the global average climate of the Earth. And so I thank you so much for inviting me, and I hope we can take a few questions, and thank you.
But what if we burn all the fossil fuels we can get our hands on? Richard Alley answers this question in the short Q&A session.
The question was, if we burn all the fossil fuels, where do we get to? And there's this huge gap between sort of proven reserves and what we think is probably out there if we're really clever and really desperate. And so do we get it out of the oil shales? Do we get it? And people are kicking around numbers like 5,000 or 6,000 gigatons, I think is the number. There's a big number that's floating around on what might be recoverable. And if you take all of that and you turn it to CO2 pretty fast, there's some chance of getting above that Cretaceous level. And like I say, that was now, the temperatures may have been a little high at that site because the Atlantic is a little narrower and so the ocean circulation has slowed a little bit, but that was 37, 38 sea surface temperature. That was hot. So you know, you start thinking about this and saying, well, you know, if we really crank it up, are we really confident we're topping at 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or, you know, you can think of a burn it all future getting really hot.
In other words, out of control global heating where the seas could reach 38 degrees Celsius or 100 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than the human body. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the 20th century average sea surface temperature was 16.4 degrees centigrade or 61.5 degrees Fahrenheit. If we burned up all the fossil fuels, it is conceivable the average sea temperature could more than double in Celsius or rise about 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Given what it takes to heat water, that kind of super record warming would presumably take at least centuries, if not millennia. But in our strange case of rapid emissions, we really don't know. Human fossil mining is an ahistorical event. Nothing in the natural record prepares us for this. Surely humans and the ecosystems which support humans would have gone extinct before that happens. Maybe not. The delay in warming caused by sea absorption, among other factors, means we could burn many gigatons of carbon before we see the horrible results a generation or two later. But then, that change can last at least 100,000 years, as shown by Dr. David Archer in his book, The Long Thaw. You can find our Radio EcoShock interview with him as well. But will we go to these extremes? Well, look, we're already doubling tar sands production. We're fracking gas shales. We're all drilling miles deep below the ocean, all to get more fossil fuels. Right now, barring a vast revolution in our economy and our energy systems, we are headed into Thermageddon, as described by the late Greenpeace founder Robert Hunter. Top scientists know this, and they're deeply worried.
Are we, the pampered driving public, really the climate Nazis of history? To his dying day, Robert Hunter thought so, and said so, in his last book, Thermageddon, Countdown to 2030.
But wait, we didn't allow Dr. Alley to answer one of the biggest denier complaints, that the climate record often shows CO2 following a temperature rise. So how could CO2 cause climate change? That's why they want him fired, if not charged with crimes against humanity. Let's quickly dive into that.
Okay. Now, we're going to do the ice cores here briefly. This is the one that I'm supposed to be fired for. You'll remember that CO2 goes up and down, temperature goes up and down, and they sort of look like each other. But we know that the CO2 is not causing that. This is a fast Fourier transform of the temperature, and you'll notice that there's a peak here, and there's a peak here, and there's a couple peaks down here. And the position of those peaks was predicted 50 years before it was observed. And the predictions were this arrow from the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit, this arrow from the obliquity of the Earth's orbit, and these arrows from the precession of the Earth's orbit. There's no doubt that the ice ages are paced by the orbits. There's no way that the orbit knows to dial up CO2 and say change. The orbit has to change the ice sheets and other things that then have to change the CO2. And so it shouldn't be terribly surprising if the CO2 goes a little bit behind. Now remember the argument against me, CO2 lags Earth's temperature. This one scientific fact alone proves that CO2 is not the cause of the recent warming. Okay? In case, first of all, don't blame Penn State. I don't know what went wrong this time, but we do a good job. Okay? And in case you ever run into this one, and I have heard this one from important people in government as well, let me do something for you here that may prove useful if you have to discuss this out in public. There's no question CO2 and temperature have changed essentially together. The data are good. And there's not much doubt that at times the CO2 is a little bit behind the temperature by a few centuries. The temperature never goes very far without the CO2. The CO2 never goes very far without the temperature. But they're not perfectly together. Okay? So what I want you to do is think for a minute. I go out with my credit card and I'm doing Christmas shopping and I go into debt. Right? I overspend and I'm in debt. And so my credit card company is gleeful because now they can collect interest payments, and I go deeper into debt. Now, remember that interest lags debt. Now, this correspondent to my administration has said that because CO2 lags temperature, there is no possibility that CO2 can contribute to temperature. By the same brilliant logic, interest lags debt, so I never have to worry about the credit card company. They never can damage me. It's wonderful. Okay, right up. Okay, now, but you might ask the question, how do we know that interest contributes to debt? Well, first of all, if you try to, you go fundamentals of economics or bookkeeping, and they say, well, if I give money to the bank, they have my money. And if I don't have the money to begin with, I'm deeper in debt. And then you go and you try to build a little numerical model in your Excel spreadsheet, and you see if interest explains the debt, and it does. Right? So then you do this for climate, and we know that the orbits drive the warming that causes the CO2 rise, it causes more warming. The CO2 is lagging the warming. How do we know CO2 adds to the warming? Well, it's physics. And if we implement that physics in a climate model, it is necessary and sufficient to explain the warming. And let me walk through that a little bit here. Okay, so the ice ages are orbitally paced. There's virtually no globally average change in forcing. And yet there's a globally average response of 5 to 6 Celsius. Okay, what we find is when you turn down the sun in Canada in the summer, you grow ice. And the ice is reflective, and the ice grinds up rocks to make dust, and the ice changes the vegetation. Those affect the planetary albedo. And if you take a good climate model and you put in the maximum ice and the maximum dust and the maximum vegetation changes, you get about half of this cooling. And that's cheating, because you can't get the ice and the vegetation without changing the CO2 in the model. But at any rate, you only get about half. If you put in the greenhouse gases, and especially the CO2, you get the other half. And it actually agrees pretty nicely. And so this is the same as my bookkeeper that I don't have, trying to explain my debt to the credit card corporation. You look at the fundamentals, and then you look at a numerical implementation of the fundamentals and see if it quantitatively explains what happened. And we can't explain this without this.
My understanding of Dr. Alley's explanation is the same as he talked about at the end of his speech. CO2 can be a forcing, it can be a feedback. The warming effect of the CO2 molecule, it does not remember why it's there. It only remembers that it is there, end quote. When other lesser control knobs, like exploding chains of volcanoes or even the regular tilt in Earth's orbit, begin the process of warming, CO2 becomes an amplifying factor, which drives the planet into a much warmer state. That has happened many times. But now, and for the first time, a species on Earth has brought out CO2 accumulated over huge eras of time and burned it in a century or two. In this case, CO2 can be a forcing. That is, humans can trigger a great warming event, and it seems almost certain we have begun it now. Could we save ourselves by mimicking natural processes? So far, that doesn't look possible because things like rock weathering take thousands or tens of thousands of years. If we try to mine that just the right rock and grind it up and expose it to form calcium carbonate, the energy involved in the process of getting it might be greater and more carboniferous than the carbon removed. It is easier, Dr. Richard Alley says to applause, to prevent carbon from entering the atmosphere in the first place. In February of last year, Richard Alley shared the 2009 Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement with Ram Ramanathan for scientific contributions that advanced understanding of how human activities influence global climate and alter oceanic, glacial, and atmospheric phenomenon in ways that adversely affect planet Earth.
Tried to save myself, but myself keeps slipping away.
Our background music for this show is thanks to Nine Inch Nails, Slipping Away. I'm Alex Smith. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. Find a transcript of this program with a few helpful links in my blog entry for January 7th, 2010. Feel free to download and share this program as an MP3 with others from our website, ecoshock.org. Pass the word around, and thank you so much for listening.